From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Webster's Dictionary defines time as a non-spatial continuum that is measured in terms of events which succeed one another from past through present to future. Now, that's not very interesting, is it? So, what happens after we die? Does time run out? Or what about Einstein? He said time was relative. Now, things are getting interesting. But no matter what we think about it or how we define it, time just keeps moving forward. Tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock.
It's time to remember that slow has a role to play, that slow is a good thing, and we need to reconnect with our inner tortoise.
Forward time travel, that is to say, time travel into the future, is not only possible, it's inevitable.
The amazing thing is, in not one of the 300 more languages spoken in Australia is there a word for time. There is no word for past, present, or future.
At the age 12, I would stop the pendulum on the wall clock. I would remove it. I would banish the clock from the room. But all the same, at night, rang out, tick-tock, tick-tock. That was my heart beating. And I had neither the strength nor the will to tear it from my breast.
Join us this hour for a discussion on time. And first, the clock of the long now. When famed computer scientist Danny Hillis started talking with Stuart Brand of Whole Earth Catalog fame, ideas flowed. But one stuck, that our culture needed a counterpoint to today's faster, cheaper mindset. We needed a mechanism and a myth to foster long-term thinking. So they conceived the Clock of the Long Now. The Clock of the Long Now is a monument-sized, all-mechanical clock that will run for 10,000 years. It's being built on a remote high desert mountaintop in eastern Nevada. Alexander Rose, the first employee of the 10,000-year clock, told Anne Strainchamps that a metaphor for the project can be found in a story about the beams at the New College in Oxford.
When New College was built, it was the New College, but it was 1380s that it was built, and it had these huge oak beams over the main dining hall. And 500 years later, in the 1800s, when they had to renovate this hall, these beams had become rotten and they needed to replace them. And they couldn't actually just go buy them anymore in England. And most of these trees were gone from all of Europe, in fact. And it wasn't until they spoke to the school forester who said, oh, well, we have the trees that you planted. And it turns out that 500 years prior, when they built the hall, they also planted a grove of oak trees to be harvested 500 years later to replace those. And it was this type of thinking that very clearly was not going on in our society, where something even as simple as planting some acorns that could be leveraged over centuries is not even considered anymore. And so looking for those types of high leverage, time-based projects that would really inspire people for longer term thinking and at least raising awareness for which types of things might need to be thought of in the long term.
So tell me more about how the Long Now Foundation decided to try to jumpstart more long-term thinking. You've got a bunch of projects, and I think it was Danny Hillis, in fact, who said what you needed was both a mechanism and a myth.
That's right. The idea of myth building in our modern age is a bit of an odd one, and I don't think, you know, very few people are consciously going about it, but in order to build a myth, I think it's required that we do build a mechanism. And one of those mechanisms is this 10,000-year mechanical clock that'll be monument-sized, kind of architectural in scale, moving parts. And the idea is that it's a monument or, in a sense, like the Grand Canyon. When you're on the edge of the Grand Canyon or if you're looking through a telescope, you get a sense of this kind of cripplingly large sense of time. What we're after is something that extends that sense of time, but doesn't make it feel overwhelming like geologic or astronomic time does. That's 10,000-year time frame was chosen as the amount of time that human culture has, modern culture has been around, and cities have started about 8,000 years ago, and agriculture right before that. So this is our kind of our modern now, and this is how far we should be looking forward if this is how far we can look back in our technology and society.
And so this is a clock that ticks off the seconds, the minutes, and the hours, but is simply going to run for 10,000 years?
No, the 10,000-year clock is the fastest moving parts in it move at about 10 seconds a tick. So it ticks much slower than your average clock. And the types of things that it shows are natural cycles of various planets and the years in different calendar systems, as well as the stars. And so a bunch of natural cycles that are relevant over these periods, and the longest cycle being the 26,000-year precessional cycle of the Earth on its axes, that's called the precession of the equinoxes.
Does it ring, or does a bell chime at any point?
Yeah, in fact, the bells chime in the current design, they chime every single day. And Danny Hillis and Brian Eno and I and the technical team all worked on a device that we recently finished that's a prototype for how the chimes would ring. And Danny came up with an algorithm that can ring a series of 10 bells in a different sequence each day for 10,000 years. And we recently built a physical instantiation of that so that the bells can ring every single day that a visitor comes by, but would be different every day.
For 10,000 years.
For 10,000 years. So over 3.5 million combinations.
What does the clock look like? Well, I guess it's not built yet, right? So you're still
We've built several prototypes. Our first prototype is at the Science Museum in London. We have several more here in our offices and museum in San Francisco. The full-size version of the clock, which we're still designing, will basically be a walkthrough experience that will have a large vertical tunnel that you go up a spiral staircase around parts of the clock and then arrive at the top and see the chamber that has the dials of all the various astronomical cycles as well as the calendric cycles. And so this would be the architectural version that we're now working on. And the smaller versions of the clock that we've built each have components of that, but we have yet to build all of that into one clock yet.
So this is not so much clock as monument, or both, like Stonehenge, maybe.
Yeah, in a sense, Stonehenge was a large clock, at least by many people's take on what Stonehenge was built for. But this will have moving parts. You know, it's very much an engineering solution to a problem. Yet some of those problems are very different than most engineering solutions in that we also have to solve them to a high aesthetic, because the main purpose of the project is to kind of entrance people about the idea and to have them leave feeling changed in some way and more thoughtful about time coming out the other side.
Hmm. It must be quite a challenge just mechanically. How do you build a clock that you know will keep running for 10,000 years?
Yeah, I mean, the clock design is meant to keep running for 10,000 years, but it does assume a certain amount of periodic maintenance. It's not assuming total neglect from people. For instance, the power system for the clock is twofold. One is it uses the temperature difference of day to night of expanding and contracting metal to power just the ticking aspect of the clock, the part that keeps time. But if you want to see what time it is, the visitors themselves have to feed power into the clock. So the dials will show you the time of the last visitor, and the chimes won't ring until you wind up the clock and the dials will update to your now, the day that you're there, and the chimes will ring for the day that you have arrived. So it needs some energy from people as well as using the energy of natural cycles like the sun.
And it's the energy from the natural cycles from the sun that keep it measuring the time?
That's right. So the very basics of it is just the ticking aspect that's measuring the time. The pendulum is powered by the temperature difference of day to night. And it's also synchronized to the sun in that we have a slot that allows sunlight in facing south so that right at solar noon, sunlight comes in and hits a piece of metal that expands and gives us a mechanical trigger that synchronizes the clock so we know it won't drift over the long haul.
So you imagine people in the future, you know, 100 years from now, say, coming to visit this clock. Where will it be?
We have a site in eastern Nevada that it's a kind of a keyhole property in the Great Basin National Park. It's an 11,000-foot mountain called Mount Washington, and it's a limestone escarpment. That's about 1,000 feet of solid limestone on top of the amazing desert landscape out there. And it's covered in bristlecone pines, some of the oldest living organisms on the planet. Some of those trees are dated to almost 5,000 years old.
Wow. You know, the kind of sense of time that you're talking about, this, I guess somewhere on your website I read it was, you call it deep time, made me wonder, does the experience of time change, do you think, when you think about it in such huge increments? I mean, does time actually feel different when you're thinking about it in great big huge chunks?
Well, I think a natural way to think about time, especially as you push out this far, is to think about it much more generationally. You know, if you take the 20, 25-year generation model, it's about 400 generations that we're talking about. So you'd have to tell the story 400 times and pass it on and create to keep the myth alive, basically. So then it starts feeling a lot more tractable, and especially given that people live far longer than 25 years at this point. So in terms of my personal life, I certainly look at things slightly differently than I would in a lot of other jobs where the projects that I'm working on are pushing out much further. And all of a sudden, my materials choices of everything I do in my life, even when I was working on projects in my house, you know, how long do I really want this to last? And I think it's changed the way I look at the world in that way.
That's Alexander Rose discussing The Clock of the Long Now. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. For photos of the clock, go to our website at ttbook.org. As Rose mentioned, The Clock of the Long Now has chimes designed by Brian Eno and Danny Hillis. Here's a chime from the 5,000th year. Ever since H.G. Wells' 1895 classic, The Time Machine, science fiction's been obsessed with time travel. And time travel has stayed in the realm of science fiction until recently. The 1990s saw an emergence of scientific inquiry into time travel when a group of theoretical physicists at the California Institute of Technology concluded that time travel might be possible in the universe we know. Their work inspired other physicists, and today there are over 30 of them around the world studying time travel. David Toomey was inspired by their work, and his book, The New Time Travelers, looks into their findings. Steve Paulson asked Toomey how seriously we should take all of this.
This is a question of some debate at the moment. I think most physicists would agree right now that no one has proved time travel impossible, by which we mean backward, pastward time travel. No one's proved it impossible. Forward time travel, that is to say time travel into the future, is not only possible, it's inevitable in the universe that Einstein gave us. It's a consequence of special relativity.
It's inevitable? Why do you say inevitable?
We remember the parable of the twins, perhaps. If you have twins and one travels out into space and back again, a return trip to very fast speed, say very close to the speed of light, that twin will experience time dilation. That is to say, his watch will slow, his heartbeat will slow. He will experience time flowing much more slowly than the stay-at-home twin. Now, this is an extreme case, but as it happens, special relativity shows us that if I move relative to anything near me, say you're sitting on a bench and I'm sitting on the bench with you and I walk away from it and walk back, I will have experienced a little bit of time dilation. It will be so small as to be almost immeasurable, but it'll be a little bit. And I will, when I return to the bench and sit back at your side again, I'll be a little bit younger than you will be. So time travel into the future is happening all around us all the time. We're all moving into the future at different rates as we move.
So why would some leading physicists be so interested in this whole question of time travel? I mean, what's at stake here?
What's at stake here? A number of things are at stake here. One is the problem of causality. In science fiction, for instance, time travel is a favorite trope of science fiction authors. There are two very interesting problems that are often presented in science fiction. One is the grandfather paradox. That is to say, if I jump into a time machine, go back in time long before I was born, find my grandfather and kill him, I cannot have been born. However, if I'm not born, there's no one to go back in the time machine to kill my grandfather. Therefore, he lives and fathers my father, who fathers me, who lives to jump into a time machine and goes back. You see the problem.
Right, right. It would seem to be an insoluble problem.
It would seem to be. And that is one question that pastward time travel encourages us to think about. Another one is sometimes called the bootstrap paradox. That is to say, this isn't a paradox precisely as the grandfather paradox is, but this is a problem in causality because it's a way to get something from nothing. Suppose, for instance, I want to write a book, but I don't want to take the time or effort to do it. What I could do if I had a time machine is go into the future, find myself at a future date with the book, take the book with me back into the time machine to the present, and just copy it all out. The question here is, where did that book come from? I didn't write it. I found it in the future, but my future self didn't write it either because he had it all along, and the book would seem to have been generated quite literally from nothing through the use of the time machine.
These kinds of scenarios are, I have to say, they're fascinating. They sound more like the kind of stuff that science fiction writers puzzle over rather than scientists. I mean, do scientists really struggle with these paradoxes?
Those paradoxes are of interest to philosophers, but they're of interest to physicists because they meet with questions of causality. And causality, that is, the belief that cause must precede effect, that effect must follow cause. That's a basis of all our science and all our understanding of how the universe works. And if that is undermined, well, then maybe we have some serious problems. Then maybe we have a lot of work to do.
Now, you've said that time travel works, at least theoretically, backwards as well as forwards. Now, the forwards part is you can kind of see that, but backwards, why are physicists so convinced that it works in that direction as well?
Well, I don't want to say they're convinced that it works. They are asking questions about whether it works, and I think we could safely say no one has yet proved it doesn't work that way. To make it work that way, you would need a wormhole, which is a tunnel through space-time. And we don't really know for sure that there are such things. Wormholes themselves are theoretical. What you'd then do with the wormhole to make a time machine is do what we did with the twins, leave one at home, move the other very quickly forward and backward or out into deep space and back again, and put them together again. Then you'd have a hole that would be a tunnel into the past.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And a wormhole, can you briefly explain what a wormhole is?
Sure. If one imagines the three dimensions of the universe as just two dimensions on a piece of paper and draw X's on that paper, say you draw the X's 5 inches apart. They are 5 inches apart. One would have to travel those 5 inches to get from one to the other. But if you bend space-time, that is to say, in this example, bend the piece of paper and fold it so that those two X's are overlapping and touching. And then if you punched a hole in the paper between the two X's through the paper, one would have created, well, this is kind of a metaphor for what would happen, what one could do in the space of three dimensions.
What I find fascinating about this whole subject is the physicists, or some of the physicists who are interested in this, are not just kind of fringe characters who are into wacky stuff. I mean, these are some of the leading theoretical physicists of the day, aren't they?
Exactly. And that's what I found fascinating about this when I began it. I've always been interested in time travel as a science fiction trope, as everyone is. But it came as a surprise to me to discover that there were people thinking about this seriously. Yes. And the papers they're publishing on the subject are in the leading journal in theoretical physics, which is Physical Review D. And there are literally hundreds of papers on this, and it has been a subject of serious inquiry now for 15 or 20 years.
All of this reminds me of something that the physicist John Wheeler once said. He had a famous bit of advice: find the strangest thing and then explore it. And that seems to be something that a lot of these physicists have really taken to heart.
Yes. Yes, it has. And they get used to thinking about strange things. That, I think, is the strangeness of this is exactly what makes it interesting.
There is the theory of the Mobius, a twist in the fabric of space where time becomes a loop, 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 where time becomes a loop.
David Toomey is the author of The New Time Travelers, A Journey to the Frontiers of Physics. Steve Paulson spoke with him. If you'd like to share with us your thoughts about time, please do so at ttbook.org.
Where time times loop loop, 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 where time comes loop loop, where time comes loop loop, where time comes loop, where time comes loop, where time comes loop, where time becomes loop, where time becomes loop.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about time. Time travel, a 10,000-year clock. But what if you're afraid of time? What if the idea of time, of every moment going away, one after the other, never to return, becomes almost a phobia? That's the reality for renowned Russian classical pianist and composer Lyra Auerbach. She writes in her autobiographical novel, The Mirror, that she spent her life in terror of time.
I think around the age of 6 or 7 was when the concept of time became troublesome and disturbing. Mm. That was the time when I started to realize that I imagined time as some kind of a monster that was devouring the seconds and minutes of our days and bringing us closer to the end. So around the age of 6 or 7 was when perhaps the anxiety started.
In your autobiography, you even use the word terror, I guess. In fact, would you read that little section of your autobiographical novel?
Yes, here is one excerpt where I talk about time, and this is from the novel. It's called The Mirror. In the darkness, in childhood, lying at night with eyes wide open and listening to the ticking of the clock on the wall. Second followed by second, and they knew for certain that those seconds would never return. They sunk into oblivion. Later, this terror intensified, and at the age 12, I would stop the pendulum on the wall clock. I would remove it. I would banish the clock from the room. But all the same, at night, rang out tick-tock, tick-tock. That was my heart beating. And I had neither the strength nor the will to tear it from my breast.
It's a very real fear. In your real life, if you will, in the life that you're living, you have found ways of accommodating yourself to this, music being the main one, which is interesting in a lot of ways because music is all about time, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Music is the art of sound in time. And in a way, one may say that music is the architecture of time. And it only exists in time.
You can't hear music, you can't play music, you can't even imagine music without a sense of the time in which it is developing. And I guess what I find interesting is that with this terror of it that you had, you would find some solace in perhaps describing time with music?
Oh, absolutely. In one of my poems, I wrote that all my life is a dialogue with time. And this theme of a dialogue with time is quite apparent in both music and also in my poetry. Music is especially an extremely interesting art form because it's so connected with time and because it doesn't exist outside of time. And it also presents many curious questions. For example, in the musical composition, does the time flow from past to future? On one level, one may say that yes, that musical composition starts with the first note and it proceeds until the end. So in a way, it flows from the point A to point B while all the metamorphosis and development of the material happens. But there is also another aspect to music. And if we think of any musical composition, we in a way get an essence of the piece, which is condensed to a point. It's almost like a flash. It's the way memory works. We almost experience time vertically, where the past and the future are all condensed to one singular point. And in that way, it's much closer to the way music is conceived, because when a composer gets an idea of the musical composition, the details are unknown, but there is this singular point which already contains all the continuity of the musical composition. So it brings so many levels of dealing with time. For this piece, the dialogue with time, it's a rather tragic work, and the concept behind it is that there is this cage of repeated, very steady notes, and then there is a melodic material that is very human and that is in a way fighting against the gravity of this cage of steady notes. So there is this underlying tragedy and tension between something that wishes to be very free and very unconstrained, which is in a way our human nature, and something that is predetermined and is unchangeable, which is perhaps concept of time.
I wonder if you would talk a little bit about one more piece of music. Could you tell me about After the End of Time?
Yes, this piece is very much like a surreal landscape, apocalyptical nature. It's in a way my fantasy of what is it like if time no longer exists, what happens after the end, if anything. So it's a very surreal musical dream.
And non-existent time in it will not overpower us.
Hopefully.
Lyra Auerbach on Time. Auerbach's a classical concert pianist and composer. Her autobiographical novel is called The Mirror. To hear more of her musical compositions or solo piano performances, please go to our website at ttbook.org. While you're there, you can send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Several years ago, Carl Honoré decided to just slow down. He wrote a book in praise of slowness, celebrating a group of Italian chefs who've done the same thing. A word spread, and the slow food movement was born. By now, a lot of people have tasted the joys of slow, and the movement has grown way beyond food. Honoré sketched out the latest developments of the slowness movement for Anstrange Champs.
I talk about it as a cultural revolution, if you like. And I know that those are very big words, but I think that they're apt here. It seems to me that if you go back to the end of the 19th century, when the culture of acceleration really got into full swing, you had the emergence of the futurists, for instance, in Italy, who glorified speed, who talked about the beauty of speed, that speed became an end in itself. You go to the end of the 20th century, and it seems to me we've come out the other end of that upward curve of acceleration, where we're saying to ourselves now, right across the planet, at every socioeconomic level, people are saying, you know what, speed is great, you know, speed is good, it has a lot to offer, but it's not always the best policy, and that it's time to remember that slow has a role to play, that slow is a good thing, and we need to reconnect with our inner tortoise, if you like. And I think that the 20th century was all about unleashing our inner hare. Now it's time for the tortoise to come up alongside the hare so that we have both. We have moments when we're fast and we have moments when we're slow. And really what slow is about, when you drill down to the bottom of it, is about doing things at the right speed and doing things at what the musicians call the tempo giusto, the correct tempo or pace that every moment or person or activity has.
You first brought the beginning slowness movement to the public's attention with a book you wrote 5 years ago or so. How's it changed in the intervening time?
Well, it's been an extraordinary ride, and it's just astonishing to me how many different ways around the world people are taking this idea of slow and finding ways to apply it to, you know, the blossoming of movements like slow design, slow fashion, slow parenting, slow travel is huge at the moment. And it's extraordinary, really. It's really quite inspiring to think that this is, I mean, it's a paradox in a way that the slow movement is growing so fast. but in a way, that's good fast. That's what we're talking about here, that there are moments of, you know, good slow and bad slow. And there are moments of good fast and bad fast. And I'm relieved and pleased, I think, to see the slow movement growing strongly. And people getting it.
So what are some of these new avenues of slowness that are opening up? You mentioned slow fashion, slow design. What are those?
Yeah, well, slow design is looking at how we make things, and that's every link in the chain. So when you're thinking, and again, this is coming back to the slow idea of what you do affects everything around you, the bigger picture. So you something that's slow design is about making it with products that, you know, and don't harm the environment, or maybe they're fair traded on an economic level with the people you're acquiring the raw materials from. And then they're made in a way that they're designed not to be disposable and throwaway. They may even be products that encourage people to slow down, you know, a big comfortable bench that you place in a waiting room or something. So people are bringing this idea of also the creative impulse that we have as human beings is very much allied to slowness, because it's when the brain is in a relaxed state that the brain waves begin to move out in richer, more nuanced, more creative patterns, and that's when you get those eureka moments. So slow design is also about taking a deep breath and letting things happen, you know, letting that inventive spark occur and then going with it at the right speed and so on, and making things not necessarily on a huge industrial scale, but maybe making them on a smaller scale.
You mentioned slow parenting. What's that?
Well, I think that's taking the same slow idea and applying it to child rearing. I think that the virus of hurry has infected the way we think about children. And you see it in the school system, where kids are crammed with academic learning younger and younger and then tested over and over and over again, homework piled high. And of course, technology. I mean, children wired from the moment they're out of the womb. You've got them being placed in front of screens to watch baby TV or baby Einstein DVDs and so on. And I think there's a wealth of evidence that suggests that that is not the best way for children to develop. And so the slow philosophy comes to bear in the sense of saying, well, it's about finding a balance. Some technology is fine, and of course you have to give children a push from now and again, but they also need slowness. In fact, I think children probably need slowness more than adults do, because it's in those unstructured, free play moments that kids learn how to think creatively, how to invent, how to get along with each other. It's when they learn how to take pleasure from things, and it's when they learn, maybe most importantly of all, who they are rather than what we want them to be. You know, understand that each child has his or her own tempo giusto, you know, their own rhythm, and some children will be late bloomers and others will learn things at different rates. The childhood should not be a rat race. It's not a dash to a finish line. It's much more complex and blurry and fuzzy, and in the end, much more thrilling and enriching because of that, I think. It's not full speed ahead.
Now, another aspect of the worldwide slow movement is slow travel.
Yes, that's something you're seeing a lot of now. And that's the reaction against the fast-forward approach to travel, where you hop on a plane, you fly somewhere, you do 50 things, you have lunch, you fly back the next day, and you've just passed through in a blur and also taken a heavy toll on the environment as well. And slow travel is about taking some of that heat out of the way we move around the world. And so it can start with how you get from A to B. Rather than jumping on a plane, maybe you take a bus or cycle, or, you know, obviously not all destinations that works for, but you enjoy the journey as much as the destination, because that's another part of slow. It's about appreciating getting from A to B rather than instantly wanting always to be at B. So slow travel is about enjoying the trip, the anticipation, the build-up, looking forward to arriving in the place. And then when you actually arrive at the place, not overstuffing your schedule and trying to see every single site listed in the tourist guides, but maybe picking two or three and spending time there, just sitting on a bench, soaking up the architecture or listening to the local voices and taking in the smells, and also having a more real and local experience, because so much of what our fast-forward culture is about is the rubbing away of local wrinkles. You go everywhere now and there's a Gap, there's a Starbucks, everything is the same, the same hotel chains. And I guess slow travel is about finding the unique, ungoogleable, if you like, the fine grain of a place. And that takes time to find those details, because when you're rushing through, everything becomes a blur. It's when you slow down that you really engage. It's really when you have those moments, those sometimes very small, simple, even free moments that burn themselves into your memory and become lifetime memories to look back on. So there's been a big push for slow travel in the United States, but around the world, and people rethinking how we get around the planet and what we make of the places when we actually get there. And of course, as an addendum to that, with the skyrocketing price of fuel now, you're finding that planes are flying more slowly to conserve energy, and buses are traveling more slowly, and people are driving more slowly. And so there's almost a kind of compulsion now to slow down. The system is forcing us to slow down. So I think that's an interesting little bit of grit in the argument now. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, if people chafe against that and find it really irritating, or if it helps them, if it guides them into seeing the joys of taking things a little bit more slowly, traveling a bit more slowly.
How has the slow movement and your interest in it changed your own lifestyle? What does slowness look like when you put it into practice?
It's a funny thing, actually. On the surface, you might think that I haven't slowed down at all, because I travel and I write and I talk. I have a full life, but actually when you inhabit my life, it feels very different. There's a very clear before and after for me. Before, I was always trying to do more and more things more and more quickly. I never said no to anything. Whereas today, I still do a lot of things, but I don't do too many things. And I always try and give, wherever possible, the time that each thing deserves. It's funny, it's a hard thing to measure, but I used to feel constantly worried about the time and feel rushed. I almost never feel that way anymore. And the irony is that I seem to get a lot more done, which is the beauty of slow, is that often slow is a lot more productive than fast.
Karl Honoré is known as the unofficial godfather of the slowness movement. His new book is called Under Pressure, Rescuing Childhood from the Culture of Hyperparenting. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him.
Even a stopped clock gives the right time twice a day. Even a stopped clock gives the right time twice a day. Even a stopped clock gives the right time twice a day. Even a stopped clock gives the right time twice a day. Even a stopped clock gives the right time twice a day. Even a stopped clock gives the right time twice a day. Even a stopped clock gives the right time twice a day.
Wade Davis is the closest anthropology will ever get to a superstar. He's got degrees from Harvard in biology, anthropology, and ethnobotany. He wrote the bestseller, The Serpent and the Rainbow. He's National Geographic's explorer in residence. And as you can imagine, Wade Davis has traveled to the remote reaches of our planet. But it wasn't until recently, with his visit to the Aboriginal people of the Northern Territory of Australia, that he came upon something that really gave him pause. It was the Aboriginal idea of the dreaming, an existence with no linear time. Wade Davis told Steve Paulson that the dreaming is one of the great experiments in human thought.
There was something about the Aboriginal people that deeply offended the British. And of course, their conclusion was that, after all, we are once again dealing with savages, and in this case, the lowest of the low. What the British completely failed was to understand the subtlety of the Aboriginal mind. And therefore, they were debating as recently as 1902 in Parliament, in Australia, whether or not Aboriginal people were in fact human beings. In the 1930s and 40s, you could virtually shoot and kill an Aboriginal person, quote-unquote, trespassing on your land with impunity. As recently as the 1960s, a colleague of mine, an anthropologist, said that growing up in South Australia, he had a book in school called A Treasury of Fauna of Australia, which included Aboriginal people in the 1960s
wow.
as part of the fauna. Now, what was really going on? What was going on was that the British were encountering a whole nother possibility of life itself. The Aboriginal mind embraces reality on two different levels. On the one hand, there's the realm of the phenomenological realm, and there's also the realm of the dreaming. So the world both exists as you see it before your feet, but it is always waiting to be born in the realm of the dreaming.
Just so I understand this, so there's one sense of time that would probably be kind of like our sense of time. I mean, you know, if they're going out to...
No, actually, the amazing thing is in not one of the 300 more languages spoken in Australia is there a word for time.
Really?
There is no word for past, present, or future. And this isn't, incidentally, hippie ethnography. This is just the way they thought.
Wow. But I would think that just in terms of, let's say, if they're going to go out and track and hunt an animal, I mean, clearly there is a sense of linear time there, what you have to
do to be able to bring down the animal. And that's a very good point, Stephen, because obviously there's also great capacity for deductive logic. I mean, for example, if you do, as we did, go out with the Aboriginal people on a kangaroo fire drive to hunt animals, they track the animals with a perspicacity and a clear and deductive process of logic that would put Sherlock Holmes to shame. So we're not talking as if these individuals were incapable of thinking, quite to the contrary. And obviously the fundamental rhythms of a day, the sun rising in the morning and setting in the afternoon, the moon coming up, gives you a sort of diurnal sense of the passage of time. But that's not really the point. The real thrust of what was going on is this idea of the dreaming, which is very difficult to define in clear terms, is that if everything in the West was about progress, dreaming is the opposite. The dreaming was all about stasis, constancy, the perfection of the world as it existed in the eternal moment.
So there's something about dreaming that connects you to that origin, to that first moment. You're immediately connected with that past many eons ago.
That's exactly the point, is that there is no sense of separation between the moment in time when the ancestors brought the world into being and all of human activity. The entire thrust of human intellectual and spiritual effort is not to change the world or to change yourself, but to do the complete opposite, to engage your ritual and ceremonial gestures that are deemed to be essential to keep the world exactly as it was at the time of the first dawning. It's as if every single intellectual impulse in the Western philosophical and technological tradition had gone into maintaining the Garden of Eden exactly as it was, each shrub pruned perfectly to replicate the world just as it was when Adam and Eve had that fateful conversation.
So how did people get access to this dream time?
The dream time existed in multi dimensions at all times. They were part of the dreaming. It wasn't like they had access to the dreaming. It wasn't like it was a hallucinogenic state or a state of altered consciousness. The dreaming is the definition of the unity of the now. The dreaming is everything that ever existed, everything that exists today, and everything that will ever exist. And so you are encased by definition in the realm of the dreaming. This was not a civilization without a history. In a way, it was a civilization through their idea system that had, in fact, defeated the very notion of history.
You have called the dream time one of the great experiments in human thought. And I'd love to sort of speculate on what you mean by it. I mean, this was a whole different conception of time, nonlinear time. And I guess it does make you wonder if all of humanity had this nonlinear sense of time, where would we be today?
Well, it's a good question. We'd be somewhere very different, and we wouldn't be where the people who first reached Australia began. I mean, you know, in our society, certainly since the revelation and then liberation of the Enlightenment and then the triumph of our scientific model and paradigm whereby phenomena couldn't exist if they couldn't be measured, and therefore all issues of myth, metaphor, and mysticism were sort of washed away. I mean, that brought us great precision of thought, but it also brought us kind of a certain isolation in the universe, because for most of human cultures, for most of history, myth and mysticism and some religiosity have sort of defined a blanket of comfort that we insulate ourselves with as conscious individuals. I always find it interesting to pay attention to the metaphors of a culture. So, for example, in the Andes of Peru, everybody is raised in those villages to believe that there is a dominant mountain deity, an Apu spirit that will direct his or her destiny. Now, this is kind of a natural conclusion if you're raised in the Andes in an agricultural civilization where you see the clouds coalesce around the mountains, you see the rain fall to the fields, you know what can happen if frost or hail strikes your harvest and can wipe it out in 15 minutes. There is a natural tendency to view the mountains as a source of both fertility and life and potential danger. So the idea of having this dialogue with a mountain is not as esoteric or obscure as it may sound. But the bottom line is, that makes those children of the high Andes very different than a kid growing up in Wyoming who's been taught implicitly and explicitly that a mountain is simply a pile of rock or coal ready to be mined. There are real consequences to these different belief systems. Now, I'm not saying that I would personally want to live the life of Aboriginal people in Australia before contact. I'm not saying that what they achieved is better or worse than what we achieved, but it is certainly interesting in the sense that, again, had we all followed that track of maintaining the world as it was at the time of the first dawning, yes, we would not have made the scientific, technological inroads that we've made and the great successes that we've accomplished. But we also wouldn't have torn down the ancient forests. We wouldn't have depopulated the fish in the seas. We wouldn't be talking about global climate change affecting life support systems of the planet and all the other, not hysterical, but demonstrable consequences of a particular set of choices that our technologically oriented civilization chose to do.
Wade Davis is National Geographic's explorer in residence. He's the author of numerous books of fiction and nonfiction, including the bestseller The Serpent and the Rainbow. Steve Paulson spoke with him. This hour, we've spent a lot of time talking about slowing down time, but it didn't seem right to reach the end of a show about slowing down time and not actually, well, do it. So, we bring you a sample of Leifinga's nine-beat stretch. It's Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, stretched out over 24 hours. Now, if that's not enough for you, you can stream the entire 24 hours of the stretched Beethoven's Ninth Symphony on our website at ttbook.org. Enjoy. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Facing Time, program number 315A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane and Anne Strangechamps, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Thanks to our intern, Claire Radomski, and special thanks to freesound.org. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.